Geopolitics and Empire is joined by author, blogger, and journalist Ian Davis of iandavis.com. He also contributes to UK Column and Geopolitics and Empire. Now, welcome back, Ian.
Thanks very much, Havoy. It's very nice to be here. And yeah, it's great to be writing for Geopolitics and Empire. Brilliant.
Yeah, I love your work. You do great analysis. And so I look forward to more pieces from you for Geopolitics and Empire. And maybe just to start off on a light note, I saw you tweet, I think, Kit Knightley's piece from off a Guardian about the Trump circus. I'm just not interested in anything Biden or Trump anymore. I feel like it's all a distraction from what is really important that we should be focusing on. What's your take with the whole Trump arrest stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's just pretty kind of crazy stuff, really. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I don't really think it's that. I don't find it particularly interesting. I find it entertaining more than anything. I mean, it's good for that from an entertainment perspective. But other than that, I mean, I'm firmly of the view that the policy is set. The policy agendas are set above kind of even presidents' heads, and what we get is a translation of those policy agendas, which are set at the global governance level, in my view.
I think it's actually meant to be entertainment, like reality TV for us. So getting then on to the more serious stuff, I was listening to your interview with my TNT Radio colleague, Jesse Zurwell. You were on his show talking about the article you wrote, The Banking Collapse. And everything just seems to be playing out like all of us have been talking about the last couple of years, where my running theory is Peter Thiel, pulled the money. He's the guy who, implanted the nanothermite in World Trade Center 7, so to speak, symbolically. Like he pulls SVB. There was even talk about Elon Musk buying SVB, their pals, and to use that to further the Twitter X app WeChat thing. And so there's something going on here, and it just seems like they want to doing the same thing over and over. What they did during the pandemic: wipe out the middle class, lock down the small businesses, shore up the monopolies like Amazon, Costco, Walmart. Now they're doing the same thing with the banks: wipe out the local small banks, shore up the big banks, bring in the CBDCs. What's your take with what's going on here?
Yeah, it's quite right. It's the same model repeated again, isn't it? I mean, and the interesting thing about Thiel as well is that he's, I wrote another piece a while ago for UK Column about his involvement with something called the Dark Enlightenment, which is, he's an accelerationist. So this is taking sort of Schumpeter's creative destruction to the max, believing that everything needs to be torn apart in order for it to be rebuilt in some sort of, kind of utopian. In the Dark Enlightenment, which it was inspired by something that an article that Thiel wrote that I can't remember. That I think I cited it in the actual article itself. But the idea is that you deliberately destroy what's currently exists in order to rebuild the new Nirvana, which would be, in Thiel's case, would be totally unrestricted. He calls it free market, but it's, if you look more into what he's actually talking about, it sounds more like a sort of the monopoly of mega corporations. So, I mean, the opposite of a free market, really. So, I think his involvement is noticeable. Obviously, if you pull $42 billion out of a bank, a smaller bank as that was in one day, which is what the founders fund basically organized by, getting together with their investors, which include, people like Vanguard and BlackRock and all those kind of people as well. Their interests are represented within that fund too. They pull it all out in one day. It's bound to cause a problem. But I think the really interesting thing about the whole narrative that surrounds the SVB collapse and, the other banks as well, and then the wider contagion moving over to Credit Suisse and other places as well. And now we're talking about, Deutsche Bank's looking a bit dodgy, and, the whole thing is likely to sort of rumble on, is that it exposed at the heart of the US banking system a much, much bigger problem, which, you know, it comes to light when you start looking at the, you know, the total composite balance sheet of the entire system. The losses that are on, you know, the losses that seem to be apparent, we're talking something closer to 2 trillion rather than the 625 billion, which is the only figure that they'll admit to in terms of unrealized losses. You know, but you can apply that same kind of haircut to the you know, to the loans and leases that they've got, which they're calling assets, which would have been made at the lower interest rate. Well, now interest rates have gone up, you can apply the same kind of losses to those. And that's a $12.2 trillion asset, claimed asset. So I mean, if you take a similar kind of 10%, 11% kind of cut from that, and add that, that's another $1.3 trillion in assets to the 6.25, you know, 650 billion. Then you come in something closer to 2 trillion. And then there are other losses on that portfolio. There are other losses on that balance sheet as well that you would, you know, need to look at more. But safe to say it's 2 trillion. So you're talking about something that is unrecoverable, really, in terms of, you know, to in the long term, that can't continue. You've got a, you know, massive debt to GDP ratio in the US and across the whole kind of Western economy, really. And, you know, as Mark Carney said a few years ago, the center cannot hold. So, you know, and we're seeing that writ large with that SVB collapse. So what they're doing at the moment is sort of continuing the kind of life support, sort of getting it to tick over for a bit. To what ends, we might wonder. I mean, surely sooner rather than later, it is going to go completely pop, at which point, you know, there needs to be some sort of rescue package. And if we look at what the you know, the Fed have done subsequently, and noticeably, you know, what Jerome Powell was talking about to the select committee on the 9th of, I think it was the 9th of March, which was the same day that SVB went down. Well, that was the same day that Thiel and his mates were pulling everything out of SVB. Well, on the same day, Jerome Powell was speaking to a US, I think it was a Senate select committee or Senate hearing on finance, you know, talking about the fact that the Fed could launch a wholesale CBDC without congressional approval. So we could do that, you know, I mean, theoretically, we could do that, which means that we've thought about it and we are going to do that if and when we're ready. So, you know, I think that's what we're looking at. I think they're keeping it on life support. They're admitting to some losses, but not all the losses. And they're just trying to keep a little bit of faith in the market until they can finally pull the plug and bring in CBDC.
A quick shout out to our sponsors, which you can locate via the sponsor page on geopoliticsandempire.com or whose links are included in every podcast description. I've tried privacy phones in the past, such as Silent Circle's Black Phone, which turned out to be a dud. The best and really only option so far is de-Googling your phone. Now, you can do it yourself, but I've never had the time to figure that out and simply got an Above phone. They sell de-Googled phones that come with a suite of software. They also provide support and a monthly Above privacy suite with many features such as a unique phone number, encryption, email, VPN, and so forth. If you're looking for a private phone, check out Above phone. Make sure to click on the Above phone link on geopoliticsandempire.com or via the podcast description so that we can enjoy a commission. Also, check out the Nomos Time Bank at nomos.net, which you can download in Spanish or English to your Apple or Google or de-Googled phone. Nomos allows people in your community to exchange services using time as a currency rather than fiat money. This will be one great way to survive in the coming algorithm ghetto. If you need health insurance, you can talk to my friend James Guzman of the Borderless Blog Podcast and Health Insurance. He offers free consultations. Simply schedule a time with him over at borderlesshealthinsurance.com. Finally, you can donate directly to Geopolitics and Empire, consult with me, the host, or become a member to join private monthly member Zoom calls where we shoot the breeze discussing world events.
And we can talk about all of this other stuff, I mean, surrounding the banking collapse and, you know, all these other banks. But I think
that's all background noise. For me, the main point is what you just mentioned. You know, what's the next step? Where are we going? It's the CBDCs. They've wanted to take us there. They're taking us there. These banks are collapsing. It's interesting. You were mentioning in your interviews previously the FedNow that's coming online in the summer. Interestingly, I had my one of my recent guests, Emmanuel Daniel, who's a fintech global thought leader. I saw him tweet that he said FedNow has nothing to do with CBDCs. I mean, I respect all my guests and their opinions. I'm kind of not buying it. And it just seems like the most important thing now is we're going in, they're bringing us into the CBDCs and all countries. So it's not just US, but everyone everywhere. You know, Lagarde at the EU is talking about it. She even mentioned that it's a control mechanism. So your further thoughts on how we're going to get to these CBDCs? Is it going to be just like a slow patchwork forward, or you know, your further thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key thing to CBDC is interoperability. This is what the Bank for International Settlements have been mainly focused on. So I think CBDC is an inevitability. I mean, if you look at the Atlantic Council CBDC tracker, we've got 114 nations around the world last time I looked, representing something like 95% of global GDP, are fully on surging ahead with CBDC. The fact is that if you can conquer the interoperability problem, which is what the Bank for International Settlements, as I said, have been working on, then each individual nation state can have its own version of CBDC. And it might be a slightly different model. I mean, a lot of people are assuming it will be based on some sort of blockchain, but it doesn't have to be. You know, obviously, there are different forms of distributed ledger technology. It could be a different type of distributed ledger technology. It could be a different coding. You know, it doesn't even have to be on DLT based. It could be, you know, there are lots of different models and options that a CBDC could operate upon or be issued through. But the point is, it's about being able to settle them instantly. This is the point. It's about being able to settle them internationally nearly instantaneously for all cross-border transactions. If that happens, which, you know, the SWIFT system recently, you know, announced its test of interoperability, which it had sandboxed, I think it was about four or five different currently functioning CBDCs, and tested them for interoperability, and yet they've got this system that they can present. There's similar system that the BRICS have put forward. I can't remember that. Is it that their LFT system that the BRICS have announced? And I think with the FedNow thing, yeah, no, that's absolutely true. It's not directly linked to central bank digital currency, and it's not the only kind of sort of settlement system or digital settlement system that countries are operating around the world. ECB operates one, you know, lots of different, you know, central banks are operating similar systems. And to that extent, the Fed's, you know, FedNow system is similar. But what it is a interoperable settlement system. And that's the key. That's laying the foundation for the seat. That's, you know, that's the basis for a global CBDC network. So, you know, in and of itself, it's not, you know, it's not CBDC related, but it's the preparation of the groundwork to enable a kind of a globally interoperable system of central bank digital currency. You know, and now more recently, we've seen, you know, the digital pound has been launched, and that's got a what they're calling their platform model. And the platform model is you're going to have an API, because one of the problems with central bank digital currencies, and one of the things that I think has been the central banks have been obsessing about, is how, you know, central bank currency issued as a liability directly of the central bank cuts out the money creation scam that the commercial banks have been riding along on for the last, you know, 50 odd years or so. So what's in it for them? You know, the commercial banks might be looking at and have looked at CBDC and thought, well, hang on a minute. I mean, that's going to undermine our business model. So what the Bank of England have done, and it's in the platform model that they put forward is almost exactly the same as the platform model that's been put forward in Russia, is that you would have the central bank would have this API layer, which commercial banks would then act as the payment gateways, the nodes, if you like, if it was on a DLT type thing. It would be the nodes that are then used as the payment gateways to access the API layer that would be managed centrally by the central bank. But this is the key. What they've said is that the programmable aspect of it, as in, you know, these smart contracts that enable CBDC to be programmable, where you can put in your end of it, you know, everyone can put in their slice if they can program the smart contracts themselves. They're giving that power to the commercial banks. So the commercial banks will have the power to write the smart contracts. So, you know, if you can imagine a scenario where, for example, you know, BlackRock is heavily invested in energy companies around the world. So energy providers could have a smart contract with BlackRock where every time you pay, automatically pay with your CBDC, your energy bill, BlackRock get their slice, the energy providers get their slice. It's all very carefully managed. Everyone's happy and they all go home, you know. So I think it's clear. And as I say, in a similar thing that has happened, the Russian platform is very similar. Chinese one, slightly different. But the whole point is that, you know, they need to in some way, less so in China, but they need to in some way to get the commercial banks on board. Because the commercial banks and the commercial payment systems like MasterCard and Visa and all those sort of people and PayPal and all that sort of lot, they have got the infrastructure already in place and they can control the payment system. Now, if the central banks try to stamp their CBDC model on them, there's nothing to stop a lot of those commercial, you know, multinational corporations offering an alternative. As one of the things that we've already seen in Russia is Sberbank, the sort of semi-state commercial bank in Russia, offering a gold-backed tokenized stable coin. Now, Russia have preempted that. The Russian government have preempted that, and they're working together. I mean, it's not like they're working against each other, but they preempted that with a legal framework that they set up, I think, quite a while ago, 2019, I think they set up this law on digital assets. So they're already prepared. And I think the Duma as well, more recently, has been kind of like looking more closely at regulating crypto, incorporating it into digital assets, maybe using it as within this tokenized digital asset environment. So they're bringing all the partners together. They're bringing everyone together so that they're all on board with CBDC. So when it does get time to formally roll it out, I don't think it'll be drip, drip. It'll probably start with there'll be a financial collapse and they'll say, oh, well, we need some sort of wholesale CBDC for financial stability. So that'll be the way it will start. And then but the model that has been presented for the digital pound is a retail CBDC, which means one that's offered to the public as well. It's a bit confusing because retail CBDC can also incorporate elements of a wholesale retail CBDC could be both. But as long as it's all interoperable, as long as it all works together, then you're going to get this centralized, centrally controlled, automated, probably AI controlled. Well, and it depends who's programming the AI, doesn't it? AI controlled global international monetary and financial system, a new one. And I think that's what this everything that we're seeing happening around the world at the moment is all leading up to this transition. You know, you could look at the war in Ukraine, you could look at the sustainable development, you could look at all of that. The pseudo pandemic, everything, it's all leading up to this transition to a new international monetary and financial system. And I think it's quite obvious that that's going to be based on CBDC.
I think this is one of the best explanations I've heard so far. And you make a great point where they don't want to leave any alternatives. So it's like this
web network where they're, some of us maybe have this more binary, simplistic idea that it's going to be central banks come in and roll out the CBDCs. And no, as you laid it out, they're going to hook like an octopus, hook in all everything else, PayPal, retail banks, put it all together globally, and that's it. No alternatives. And also, as you said, I think even the retail banks, maybe they'll be tasked with or they'll be linked to the directives of the central bank. And, my next question is, once this is in place, what life will be like for dissidents? Jeremy McKenzie in Canada had his Scotiabank just shut his account. In Australia, Maria Zaric, the podcaster, had her BMO bank shut her account. So, that retail bank just basically says, you're a political risk for us. You're a risk for us. Then where's that coming from? Is it the bank, or it's the bank, with its agreements that it has with the central bank, where they just classify, as you said, they're able to monitor, the banks that we all do business with, they can see our purchases that we're making, what we're doing, and they've got political, they're tracking our political, religious views. I used to have an account with Gold Money, and twice in a year, they froze my account for months on end. And I remember the owner of Gold Money saying, tweeting publicly, that they're being forced by this system, KYC rules and stuff, and that they're being forced to monitor their clients like social media and, political, religious views, all this stuff. And so your further thoughts, once this all comes to be, what is life going to be like? If you make a wrong move or wrong thought, they'll clamp down on you, no?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's the now infamous clip, isn't it, of Augustin Carsten. We can't control $1,000 bill, but we can control this, and we have the technology to enforce it. It's almost a sort of comic kind of looking at it now. It seems like an almost comic kind of James Bond type villain kind of thing to say. But the point is, unfortunately, that is pretty accurate. That is the extent of control that they will have with central bank digital currency. Because if you think at the moment, there are already laws in place. There are plenty of laws in place already to stop us, to stop money laundering and to stop, it's difficult for me, for example, to take out any kind of sizable amount of cash from a bank account. Just doing that, just going into my bank account and not asking for a load, but anything more than a few grand, and they want to know the ins and outs of your whole life story, which is all done for what? It's all done for our protection, right? So this is always the same, and there is some truth in that. Fortunately, a bank intervened in my mum being ripped off for about 15 grand. So it's not like this is all bad. And there is some truth to, we do need to be wary. There are some scams out there that we can't even possibly start to imagine, But that being said, what it means is that can be programmed into smart contracts at the platform layer. So there'll be certain flags and certain triggers that will be programmed into AI capability that will do all this kind of like management of those kind of safety rules automatically. That will be sold to the public as a great convenience, a great advantage. You don't have this problem of getting your money out, because it'll all automatically work out whether the transaction is safe or not. So people think that's great, and they think, oh, that's better than the current situation. But the problem is, as you rightly pointed out, that programmability and that smart contract capability can be used for any other reason. So if, for example, at the moment, one of the things that I think about is, you think about lockdown restrictions. At the moment, a lockdown restriction requires legislation of some sort, or at least some sort of enforceable regulation. There needs to be a way that you can say, well, no, you can't leave this area. The 15-minute city thing, you can't leave more than 15 minutes from your center of your city or whatever. Well, in a CBDC world, if, for example, your bank is fully on board with sustainable development goals and believes that, that you shouldn't be able to leave a 15-minute radius of your home, then you won't need legislation because you'll simply disable your money's function outside of that radius. So they won't require legislation. Legislation will be less meaningful, as will democracy. Democracy will be less meaningful for that, or representative democracy, let's call it. But that will have less meaning because there'll be less need for legislation. Control will be exercised through the function of your money. If there's something that they, I mean, at the moment, if they want to censor somebody or stop somebody, as they did in Canada when they wanted to stop people supporting the truckers' protest. So they, how did they do that? They had to work with the banks to disable payment systems. So they worked with online payment systems as well to stop people being able to subscribe to support their chosen cause that they wish to support. Well, with CBDC, they won't need to do that. With CBDC, that'll be centrally controlled. So they'll just disable that transaction. So you will try to say support, go to pay your money into a support fund for the truckers' protests or whatever you want to, whatever cause you want to support, or the World Wildlife Fund or whatever it is that you do want to support. And if that transaction is not approved, then that will be automatically disabled at the point of transaction. So this will all happen in real time. It will all happen in the milliseconds of an AI system. So that level of control and manipulation over society, I don't think we've ever faced anything as all pervasive and totalitarian in its scope. Traditionally, how the totalitarianism works, it works through violence. Fundamentally, it's oppression through violence. It's physical restrictions. It's, you know, maybe economic restrictions as well, but it boils down to some level of force in terms of physical force. Now, with CBDC, that won't be required any longer. Governments and international corporations won't need physical force. They'll just disable your ability to use your money in whatever conditions they wish to set. And that is a paradigm shift for the whole planet. And if we end up all of us using digital central bank digital currency, and this is the problem, if uptake reaches a certain level, then we are in deep, deep trouble, because money functions for us because we can use it in the wider economy, right? So I mean, if I want to go and buy some food, I want to be able to go and use my money to purchase that food from a local store. Now, I might violently disagree or strongly disagree with the basis of fiat currency, but nonetheless, I still have to use it if I want to go and buy a tin of baked beans. Now, if CBDC reaches a certain level of uptake, then whether we want to use it or not, if we want to go and buy a tin of beans, chances are we're still going to have to use it. So everyone will be subject to it. So we need to develop alternative systems, and we need to sort. I think the most important thing is that we start thinking about and pushing out those alternative payment systems amongst ourselves, and more importantly, get more people to realize the need for this.
And I mean, everything you say is spot on, and I do think that what you just described, this new system historically, it is also a form of violence. It's violence if you're denying a person or citizen the ability to buy food or anything. It's basically another way of throwing them into the gulag and starving them to death, or, you know, whether it's the other version of the Holodomor in Ukraine, where you just take away all the food and leave the peasants to starve. It's basically a modern version of that same thing. So in a way, it is violence. And, you know, going forward, I don't have so many answers. You know, people look to me for answers. We're trying to figure out what's going on. And, you know, one of my sponsors, Nomos Time Bank, they've got this app where you get other people to use it in your community. You can use it anywhere in the world, and they use time as a currency. So if you look for a service, you know, the barber cuts your hair for 30 minutes, he gets 30 minutes of time, and then he can use that. You know, that's one option. It's, of course, that's not a, you know, total solution. But what do you see as some? I mean, it looks very bleak, sorry to say, because if they've got control of everything, what can we do? I mean, barter. Do you have any thoughts as to what alternatives we might have in this system?
Yeah, I mean, despite the, you know, as you just said, despite the terribly bleak picture that I've just described, you know, I think there is, we've got every reason to be hopeful, because if you think about, you know, the whole purpose of pretty much everything that we see on the mainstream media is to control our thoughts and opinions. Now, the reason that they're so focused on that is that it matters to them what we think and what we do, and more importantly, what we do really matters to them. So we really, it's just a matter of realization, really. We just need to realize that the things that we do every day matter. Now, we've just seen the you know, quite amazing protests that are going on in France and the amazing protests that have been going on in Israel. Now, I am all for protest. I think protest is very, very important, because it expresses to the political class that we're not happy, right? And things have got to change. And that pressure in it, in and of itself, especially if it's on the scale of those protests, and clearly in Israel and in France, you know, you're seeing the political class kind of back off a little bit and rethink their tack. But it isn't, in my view, ultimately isn't going to change anything. The trajectory is set. So the trajectory you're on, the policy trajectory that we are all on, is set. So it's just a matter of how they can get us there. They're just shifting us there by increments. They're just getting us there however they can. Now, we can't change that, their minds, right? They've already decided that this is what's going to happen. And they might use a system of, you know, we've recently seen the World Economic Forum talk about polycrisis, where everything comes together and we're all just overwhelmed at the same time. Whatever. They're going to use whatever mechanisms they can to move us towards, to push us down this policy trajectory path. But if we realize that, hang on a minute, we don't have to follow that. You know, the things that I do every day, if I make a conscious decision, I'm not going to use my card. I'm only going to pay for things in cash. I'm not going to buy certain products because I'm not sure about, you know, where they've come from. I am not going to, you know, just go into a supermarket and buy all the cheap stuff. I am willing to pay a little bit more to support local producers. If we just take those steps, if we actively take those steps, if all those millions, probably, almost certainly, millions of people that are protesting in France, if on a similar scale, we made little decisions every day to change our behavior ourselves, because they're trying to change our behavior, but we can change our behavior. So if we change our behavior and move incrementally away from their policy trajectory, we will change everything, and there's nothing they can do about it. But we just have to realize that, and we have to realize our own agency, and we have to take control of it.
Yeah, that's great advice, and that's what I try to do as well. I've always in my life used cash as a teenager. Just for me, it's more convenient, cash. I've talked to people, oh, it's so convenient, the contact. No, cash is convenient. I know how much I have. And I don't understand people who just they don't have cash. Like, I'm always got a bundle of cash with me. If I get mugged, whatever, you know, it's not the end of the world. But, you know,
yeah,
it happens. But I always have a pile of cash when I'm walking around, because you never know what's going to happen. You might get stuck somewhere. You need cash for a taxi or a hotel, or spending the night somewhere. You might get rendition to another state or something. No, I don't know. But I'm being silly. But I did want to switch then gears to multipolarity. And I think you and I are on the same page. And I'm a big fan of Michael O'Fallon, who has this Sovereign Nations podcast and conferences. And I was catching up to, he's a Christian as well. He comes from that worldview. And I was listening to his speech last night from the conference in December. And he says, what did he say? He said that the multipolar world is the unipolar world. You know, multipolarity is unipolarity. And I agree with him, because the push to have a true world federation, or global governance or global government, you have to have multipolarity. So in a way, it's like multipolarity will lead us to this unipolar global governance system. That's sort of my view. And I think you recently tweeted, I think it was you, you said, no, who said, I think a multipolar world order could potentially reduce international conflict, but I see no evidence of its potential to serve better humanity. Those leading it are also leading on CBDC, digital idea, biometric surveillance state, and so on. End quote. Yeah, you recently tweeted that. And yeah. I would add to that as well. In my interaction with multipolaristas, who otherwise are great, I chat with them all the time on TNT Radio. I won't name any names, but I've noticed that they conveniently either avoid the topic of the algorithm ghetto altogether, or they say it's a good thing. And it's I kind of take it as sort of a cognitive dissonance. They're viewing the whole multipolar scheme as a lesser evil. So, you know, I'll talk to these people who are pro-China, and they'll either just ignore the whole social credit, you know, algorithm ghetto, or they'll say, oh, it's not so bad. It's good. And so, you know, your further thoughts on multipolarity. And I think it has to do, you know, Anthony Sutton and many others have talked about convergence. And I think the key is convergence between East and West. So your further thoughts here.
Yeah, no, I sort of largely agree with that. I mean, I think potentially, I mean, I think the problem that we get into when we talk about the multipolar world order as such, I mean, the thing that I would point to about that, it's the world order aspect of it that's the bit that we need to be worried about. Whether it's called multipolar or unipolar doesn't really matter. It's the world order bit, which is global governance. And that's the part that we need to, because that means the centralized governance of the planet. You know, I mean, obviously it's in the name, but I mean, that's not a good thing. That in itself is not a good thing. We're moving further and further away from any kind of pretense of, I mean, I would argue that there's not really any kind of democratic oversight now, but I mean, you know, we're almost, if you like, officially moving further away with it from any kind of idea of a global world, you know, global governance, world order. I mean, that's just, you know, it's no use to man nor beast, really. But I mean, the point is that the multipolar is being offered as an alternative to the unipolar. And I would agree very much with the previous comment that it's not. It's not an alternative. It's a different model of the same thing. And the same thing is, I mean, the aspects of the current offer of a global order that is on the table, the worst aspects of that, to my mind, are all those things we've just listed, in particular central bank digital currency. But there's the jabs, and there's the digital ID, and there's the biometric surveillance, and there's all that. That's the bit that I'm particularly opposed to. I mean, I'm opposed to all of it on principle, but I mean, if we get down to the specifics, those are the things that really concern me. Now, a lot of people say, well, yeah, it won't, it doesn't, you know, if you live in Syria or you live in Ukraine, these things aren't high on your priority list. And I'm sure that is absolutely true. And I totally understand that. But I don't. Most of us don't. Most of us live in other places. And for those of us that are living in other places, we really need to be concerned about this stuff, because it is, you know, what is the point of having all the advantages that we've supposedly got in life? We are fortunate enough not to be living in a war zone. We're not, you know, most of us are fortunate enough not to be starving. Most of us are fortunate enough not to be suffering from rampant disease and water degradation, well, and all that kind of stuff. You know, we have advantages that we have enjoyed for many, many years in the developed world, whether that's East or West, you know, it doesn't matter whether that's East or West. But what are the point of having those advantages if we are now willing to simply give away all those advantages because we believe in some concept, some abstract concept of the multipolar world order, which is going to save us from the thing that the version of global governance that we don't like, to be simply replaced by another version of the same thing? So that's you know, to my mind, that's a pointless exercise. And I think it is being offered to us precisely because many people in the West, and rightly so, have become utterly disillusioned with the way that, you know, for example, the United States the UK government, the European Union, with the way it conducts itself around the world, the way that it can, you know, conducts its affairs with, through economic, financial, and often physical military warfare. I mean, that's the way it's been conducting itself. This idea that we've lived in a peaceful world since the Second World War is nonsense. We haven't at all. And, you know, quite rightly, we point to these people and say, we don't want this. We want you to stop bombing other countries. We want you to stop all this. Unfortunately, the hope is that a multipolar world order might reduce international conflict, which it may well do. It might reduce international conflict. But there's a lot of reasons to be worried that it won't. I mean, you know, let's be honest, Russia, for good or ill, Russia is in its sixth war since Vladimir Putin was president. I mean, that's a lot of wars to get involved with. Now, we can argue about all the reasons why, but nonetheless, that's six conflicts. You know, China's conduct in places like, you know, Yemen leave a lot to be desired. So we can't just assume that a multipolar world order will deliver some kind of more peaceful and stable, global kind of geopolitical sort of basis. We can't. It would be nice to hope that that could be the case, but there's really not a lot of reason to think that it would be. You know, I mean, if we have all this world of poles, how are they going to manage internal conflict? You know, are they all going to be, you know, at peace with each other? Is the Pan-Americana bloc going to be totally at peace with itself, or is the Pan-Eurasian bloc going to be, you know, everyone's going to be happy with themselves? I mean, we don't know that. It's a massive leap of faith to take to just assume that that's going to produce a safer and, you know, hopefully a world with less conflict. I doubt that. But the point is, the transition to it sure as hell isn't going to be peaceful. The transition to it is certainly not going to be peaceful. And I think we've got every reason to be very worried about developments that are going on currently, you know, where Ukraine is the fulcrum of those developments, because it's quite obvious to my mind that both sides are not really that. I mean, despite what China and Russia have said about the fact that they, you know, that they would welcome peace negotiations, the war is ongoing. The conflict is ongoing. Both sides are still, you know, there's not been any kind of sign of any kind of like retraction. And the NATO, for its part, clearly wants the war to continue for as long as possible. So there's no will there at the moment that I can see to bring it to a conclusion.
Yeah. And, you know, Nikola Mikovic, Serbian analyst who writes for me, he he's looking at things objectively. He's not like, anti-Putin just for the sake of it. He's just objectively observing that what the Russians are doing, it seems like neither of them want this war to finish. The Russians want it to continue. NATO wants it to continue. Roloslavsky, who's, you know, Russian, pro-Russia, I've had him on TNT. He's got a great Substack. He said the same things. Like, what are the Russians doing? And I just had this thought, and I've heard someone comment on it as well, that I feel like there are two sets of globalist elites in the West, where, you know, going back to the petrodollar and the US dollar reserve, and we just see everyone now moving away from the dollar and the dollar declining, and, you know, maybe it's going to crash. And I think that's also to make way for this digital dollar or CBDC. And, you know, everything you just mentioned, Ukraine is helping spur that along. And it's almost like there are two sets of globalist elites in the West, where one set of elites who are in the lower tier, they're like thinking, no, we need to support the petrodollar. We have to keep it going. And then the other set of these true globalists, they have no nationality, right? They want that global government. So they're like, we're going to drop the dollar to make way for the CBDC and this global control system. And, you know, someone on my Telegram recently, subscriber, I post news from everywhere. And I posted an article from Reuters discussing how Russia is using facial recognition to catch people in Russia, whoever, dissidents or whoever they don't like. And someone said, why are you posting this? I'm like, I can't understand these people who think they're Putin Kremlin bots or what? Like, we're dealing with all mafias. You think in Russia, they don't do that? Yeah, I lived in the former Soviet Union in Kazakhstan, where they were shutting on the weekends our internet, blocking my VPNs. My email is blocked. And my email is blocked in Russia. And what else were they doing in Kazakhstan? They were trying to get, imagine this, they were trying to get the whole populace of Kazakhstan to download a Mozilla Fire or a browser certificate. That's basically spyware that then would allow all the government to see your banking login, everything. And I'm like, do you think like China or Russia or everyone's doing this? So I can't understand these people who just flip out when I share like a no. Russia's doing this. You've mentioned it before. They've done the vaccine certificates. Everyone's on joined this party. And then yeah, I don't know if you got any other thoughts. Something else that's concerning me is this, you know, we see in the US the Restrict Act. And I think basically all governments are pushing forward some form of this Restrict Act. In most countries, like in the UK, in Europe, in Canada, they're calling it the online hate speech. The US is Restrict Act. So basically what they're doing is they're now criminalizing speech, and they're bringing in the thought crime idea from 1984, where now if you just think something wrong, you can be fined $1 million, go to jail. They can take everything you like. And so I think that adds on to the whole aspect of the CBDCs and everything else. You know, your thoughts on the criminalization of speech.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, they you know, there are all these groups like Hope Not Hate and people like that that are trying in the UK and wider as well. They are trying to suggest that certain, I mean, The point about hate speech, quote unquote hate speech, is that, you know, of course, you know, there are laws, and rightfully so, to stop people inciting criminal acts. I mean, you just go on Twitter and forget about hate speech, forget about all that. If at any time since, say, Twitter or Facebook, since social media was first ever came in, I don't know when that was, when that late 90s, I don't know when it was, or early, I don't know. I can't remember when DARPA put Facebook out. When was that?
2004, I think.
Yeah, it was about 2004, yeah. So, but I mean, you know, if you went on there then and said, you know, I'm calling for somebody to be killed, you know, you would be investigated. You know, the people would be wanting to know what your IP address is and come around and find you. That's a crime. You can't start going around saying that you want people to be beheaded and stuff like that, unless, of course, you're a, you know, a terrorist that's sponsored by the CIA, in which case you can do that. But I mean, that's, you know, you can't. We've always had laws to stop us doing this kind of thing. We've never needed to be told what constitutes hate. You know, we can make up our own minds about what constitutes hate. It's obvious. We know when someone is being hateful and disrespectful and unpleasant, and we don't really like those kind of people, both online and off. We don't need anyone to tell us. We already understand that. But the point is that this whole narrative is being constructed to make you think that you don't understand that. And the sad thing is that for generations that are coming, you know, that are growing up with this stuff, they may actually find themselves in a position where they don't understand that, because they can't know what is true. They can't know what is real unless it is defined for them by some third party fact checking app. We must not allow that to happen. That is the really, really dangerous aspect of this stuff. And the point is, as you quite rightly say, is to bring all these things together. So the IMF have already spoken about using some kind of social credit mechanism for people online, which is linked to their financial activity. So they were talking about potentially, you know, like stopping people doing certain transactions and things like that if they were online and they were saying the wrong thing. Now, if in a CBDC world, if you go online and post something about, I don't know, let's say you post something saying free Julian Assange or something like that. Well, if that's frowned upon by the state, well, then they'll just disable your CBDC. So you can't pay your prescription, your subscription for your internet service provider. So you can't go online because you can't get a service because they'll disable your money. So you can't pay for it. I mean, that is the level of control that will be entirely possible with a central bank digital currency. And people just don't get it. They're not getting it. The whole thing comes together with central bank digital currency, which is tied to digital ID. So you will have to log on to use your computer, almost certainly. That because of, why would the justification for that be? As we've seen with the Online Harms Act in the UK, the justification is the protection of children, keeping people safe. It's always keeping people safe. Well, I don't know about you, but I don't want to be a safe slave. I'm not interested in that. I'd rather be at risk and a bit free, because we can't be totally free. None of us are totally free because we have responsibilities to each other. So the idea that we can just be free and do whatever we like is nonsense. But we've always known that because we are social animals that live in social groups. We know we can't go around behaving with abandon and just doing whatever we want because other people won't like it. And that's a problem for us. We know this stuff. It's inherent to us. It's our nature. We don't need to be told how to go about conducting ourselves. We just need to realize who we are. We are human beings. We're not robots. We're not AI bots. We're human beings with real feelings, real emotions, real intellect. We have real opinions, and we need to be able to free to express them. And what they want to do, the whole reason that this cartel is being imposed on us, this draconian panopticon, is to stop us doing that, because our freedom is the threat that they fear. They fear us just taking steps to move away from the trajectory that they want to send us down. So that's why all this stuff is coming together. And it's, I think we're getting to the point now. I mean, I know that I am in my writing, certainly, where I think it's time to be a little bit freer about what we say, not less free. Because they want you to feel squeezed. They want you to feel, they want you to be frightened to say the wrong thing. Well, excuse my French, but screw that. I'm not going to feel frightened by being told that I'm not allowed to hold this opinion. And none of us should. We should all be forthright in our views, providing that we are polite and that we are, you know, we're willing to be reasonable and to hold a reasonable discourse. There's no reason why we should feel restricted from saying whatever we want. And if you're going to get locked up for it and have your money, you know, your money shut down because you have said what you want, so be it. But if we all say what we want, then that's going to, you know, that's going to cause, even with CBDC, there will come a point where that will be unmanageable. Because if everybody acts as a sovereign individual, as a free human spirit, they can't control us. And that's what the whole system is designed to do.
Yeah, I've seen some people over the past, especially 3 years, some of my guests who were very cautious with the language that they used. And I've generally been saying whatever's on my mind. And then I've seen them now open up more. And it's just like, you know, back in 2020, I was comparing COVIDism to Nazism, and some people were like, "No, they believe that, but they don't want to say it." And then they finally start saying it once they see everyone else is saying the obvious. So, yeah, we need to speak freely. We've covered a lot, Ian. And so, you know, any final thought for us?
I know, really. I mean, I just enjoyed the opportunity to have a chat. There's nothing as good as a good rant, is there, to feel better. It's very cathartic. So that's good.
Yeah, my podcast as well. It's a bit therapy for me. So yeah.
Yeah. No, but I just hope that people will just think really hard about what is happening at the moment, you know, and just. Realize that the solutions are in our hands. They are in our hands. Otherwise, they wouldn't be trying so hard to control us, because we are their problem. So we need to realize that
we are their problem. We are the cancer. We are the carbon they want to reduce.
We're the carbon they want to get rid of. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So all right. Well, everyone, as you know, as Ian says, Ian's chipper, I'm chipper. We always have to be. I always say I'm going to laugh on the way to the gulag if that happens, whether it's the physical or a digital gulag, so they can't take that from us. Where are the best places? I'll include all your links as always, but you know, any particular project you got going on, or how can people support you, follow you?
Just quickly, everyone. That you're right. We should laugh at this stuff because some of it is hilarious, and we should laugh at it. And one of the, going back to a point you made earlier, we don't need to take these people seriously. There's no reason why we have to take these people seriously. And you said this idea about the two factions fighting. You think there's one set of globalists? That yeah, because they're just like us. They're just people. They're just ordinary people that happen to have an immense amount of money and power. But they squabble and backbite, and you know, their relationships break down. The kids annoy them. You know, they're people. They're not these all powerful demigods. They're just people like the rest of us. We have no reason to give them any more credit than we would give our next door neighbor. So you know, don't worry about all that sort of stuff. They're always bickering and fighting each other. They haven't got a cohesive plan. They've just got an idea where they want us to go, in my view. I'm iandavis.com, which is spelt with two I's. It's iaindavis.com. And I'm fortunate to write for Your Good Self at Geopolitics and Empire, and I often find my work at Off Guardian, also at UK Column, and Unlimited Hangout as well. I've got a big piece coming out with Unlimited Hangout shortly. So check out my work there, and go to my website. You can download my book for free there. My last book was called Pseudo Pandemic. So, you know, please feel free to just check out my work at my website.
I hope you enjoyed this Geopolitics and Empire podcast. The website is geopoliticsandempire.com, and I encourage you to sign up for the free email list that goes out with each podcast and every weekend with a collection of news headlines. The newsletter and website are our last lines of defense. We're being censored and deplatformed. It's nearly impossible to find Geopolitics and Empire on the Google search engine. We've been blacklisted. YouTube frequently takes down our videos with strikes. Facebook restricts our page. Reddit and Twitter take down posts. And after the Associated Press mentioned Geopolitics and Empire in a 2021 article co-written with NATO, our Patreon account was terminated. Vimeo also terminated our Pro account. The best free way to help Geopolitics and Empire is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere and subscribe to all of our media channels. You can find the video broadcast now on 5 platforms: Odyssey, Rockfin, Rumble, BitChute, and Brighteon. You can find the audio broadcast on the podcast ecosystem: SoundCloud, Apple, Spotify, and so on. My current favorite social media channels are Twitter and Telegram, but you can also find us on Gab, MeWe, Minds, Float, VK, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Finally, Geopolitics and Empire is in dire need of funding to continue. You can leave a donation, purchase a consultation with the host, or become a member to receive additional benefits. We also produce a weekly broadcast called Dissident Thinker for members and Rockfin subscribers only. We will continue to fight the good fight, come hell or high water. Thank you for listening.